happens after an incident is fairly minor. And, you know, I don't think devs are particularly a quiet bunch. So I assume that if it was very bad, people would speak up. So maybe we don't hear about it because it's not that bad. But I also wonder if maybe it's because we focus on the systems that we understand. So the systems that we have were built by people. They run, hopefully, logically. They hopefully run repeatably. And we understand this. People do not run quite as smoothly. You can't rely on them quite the same way to be exactly the same each time. And one person can be quite complicated. A team of people, well, you're just adding exponentially now to the complications or the complexity of the people. And if you move to a department, I mean, this is orders of magnitude much, much higher in complexity. So today, for the remainder of this talk, I'm going to ask us to be daring. I'm going to ask us to look at the thing that we're maybe less comfortable with. Maybe we feel most comfortable dealing with programs and systems because we feel like we understand them. And with people, less so. This talk might make you feel a little uncomfortable that we're diving into the human side of things. And I think that's good. I think we should talk about it. So, part of what I did in preparation for this talk was I did a straw poll. And I'm going to give you a preamble about straw polls. Straw polls are not scientific. I did not figure out the statistical correlation. I did not do an ANOVA test on this. This is just a glimpse into some of the thinking people had. And it's a way for us to launch into the conversation. But I think the numbers that you see here will be relevant even though they're not a rigorous scientific endeavor. So what I did was I talked to 40 production engineers. And I asked them a bunch of questions. And the very first one I asked was, after an incident, rate how you feel. Not stressed, a little stressed, stressed, very stressed. Okay, now in your head, just take a guess at how people responded. And remember that stressed and very stressed are the highest kind of levels here. Of those 40, over 4 out of 10, nearly half of them said that they were stressed or very stressed after an incident. That's not a small number of people. If you look at this room around you, four-tenths of people, that's not a small amount of people saying that they were stressed. But at the same time, is anyone surprised by this number? I don't see any surprised faces. Maybe the only surprise here is that this number is smaller than it could be. But doesn't that make us wonder what the effect of that is? So wait a second. We're not surprised that almost half of developers are feeling very stressed after an incident, and we just kind of leave it at there. And so really, that's what we want to do today. We're going to explore some ways that maybe we can dive into what that means and how we can try to potentially fix it. So here's some of the data that I had. So in the past month, which of the following have you noticed post-incident? Now, the font here might be a bit small, so I'll take you through this graphic. But here's an important thing. The numbers on the left, they're not a percentage. They're the actual number. So when we look at the number of people who said that they had a worse or less ability to fall asleep, it's not 20%. It's actually over half of respondents said that they had trouble sleeping after an incident. When we look at the ability to concentrate, we're not looking at 20% there. We're looking at about over half, maybe 6 out of 10, people saying that they were unable to concentrate as well after an incident. Mood, you have 2/3 of people saying that after an incident, they had worser mood. And these are people who just get up the next day, they go back to work, they're supposed to be doing their work at the same level, but right now, out of these three so far, they're sleeping worse, they're unable to concentrate as well, and they have a worser mood. Now the next one, now as someone who loves to eat, I'm actually happy with this result. So most people were okay with their appetite. They had no problem eating. About a quarter of people still ate less after that. But what I think is kind of interesting about this, then, is that people weren't just blanket writing everything is crap after an incident. They were thoughtfully going through these responses and choosing the things that affect them. So actually, looking through this data, I was happy to see that not everything was worse. People are telling us the truth about how they feel. The next one I think is really interesting. Almost half of people said that they had less desire to be social. And there's so much research out there about the benefits, the positive benefits of social interaction. There's so many health benefits, psychological benefits to wanting to be social. But after dealing with an incident, over half of people didn't want that. They wanted to kind of just hide away. Interestingly, you'll see that you have about 1 in 8 people who desire to be more social, that dealing with the stress of an incident made them want to be around people, maybe as a self-corrective mechanism. And then the last thing that I asked, which was, what is the ability to enjoy something? And here you've got over or about a third of people saying that they had less ability to enjoy things. Now, I don't know about you, but that concerns me. Because that's the whole, I mean, why do we work? We hopefully work to be able to feel good about ourselves. We want to solve problems. We want to go out there and enjoy life. And a third of people, at least in this straw poll, after an incident, find life just less enjoyable. That sucks. So through this talk, what we're going to do is we're going to start looking at how some of the other industries deal with this. Because this isn't alone in this industry. This isn't about pointing fingers or saying, what did anyone do wrong? It's asking why. Let's dive into the reasons. This is something solvable. This room is full of smart people who are solving tough problems every day. I don't think that this kind of stuff is unsolvable. So we're going to look into what doctors can teach us. We're going to look into what stand-up comedians can teach us. We're going to look into what Olympians teach us. And what these three categories are people who face similar style incidences, often at a higher scale or a higher degree, and how do they cope with it? Because I think we can learn a lot from that. All right, so doctors. Now, I'm not a fan of calling everything life and death, but doctors actually have to deal with life and death. And I think there's value in seeing a really extreme case and then being able to learn those lessons and pull it back to what we have to deal with. And so I wanted to look into doctors who deal with patients' lives and well-beings every day and say, well, how do they deal with some of this stuff? So here's what we can learn from medical practitioners. In medicine, success often means being perfect. As much as we can be very logical, I don't think that very many of us would say if a loved one was in surgery, something went wrong, I understand, probability-wise, sometimes things don't happen the way you expect. I'm okay with that. We often say, well, someone must have done something intentionally wrong. Someone must have messed up. Why did this thing happen? But what that pressure means is that often there's a term called secondary victims. And while with medical error, the patient is the primary victim, medical practitioners can often be the secondary victim because they blame themselves for not being able to stop the error from happening. Or they feel very badly, obviously, that this error happened. And so it made me think a little bit about how we could examine that for an SRE case. Because your primary victims are your customers, whether they're internal or external. But we also have secondary victims as well. The people who are trying to solve the problem can often internalize what happens around that error or the difficulty around it. And if you remember some of the numbers I gave you before, keep that in mind while I kind of go through this slide. So that word is harder than I expected to say. After errors, they reported increased anxiety about future errors, about 2/3 of them. Loss of confidence, 44%. Sleeping difficulties, 42%. Reduced job satisfaction, 42%. And harm to the reputation, 13%. Now, I include that last one because oftentimes we may know that we need to talk to someone or we need some support, but we worry about what they're going to think about us. So for doctors, 82% of them felt that peer support and counseling could help. But many of them don't out of fear. They're worried about medical liability. They're worried that if they're vulnerable and they say, I need some support right now, I need some help, that people will question their ability, people will question their confidence, people will question whether or not they're up for the job. And yet there's value in realizing that they're not alone. That's why there are studies like this happening. And that's kind of why I'm having this talk right now, is to say maybe some of the things that you feel, you're not alone in feeling. And maybe it's something you thought that you shouldn't feel. Well, if other people feel them, maybe it's not you that's the problem. And that's why I think that we need to have this talk. And there's not going to be hard solutions. I'm not going to say, and now at the end, here's 5 points that you can do. We're going to solve this. Enjoy. You know, we're going to be done. This is really the starting of a conversation. And I'm not the expert on this. I'm just presenting things I've found. And really, it's up to everyone in this room to contribute and find a way that make this better. One thing I also really thought about around doctors was this feeling that because it's life and death, then there's a feeling that they always have to be perfect. And it reminded me of SREs and how there can be hero culture, how there can be this idea that you have to be the one who solves this problem, that you have to be impenetrable, that you have to be a superhero to get things done, and to show signs of vulnerability is actually a liability. And I think that when we see about the importance of reaching out and talking to other people, that's something that's maybe doing us more harm than actually helping us. So I asked the question, are we doing enough peer support? And so here, I asked how frequently on a scale of 1 being never on the left and 5 on the right always, do coworkers reach out to see how you're doing? And nearly half, 45% of people said never. After going through something that was stressful, after going through something that made them sleep less well, that made them have a worser mood, that made them harder to concentrate, that made them enjoy things less, almost half of people had no one reach out to them. 35% gave it a 2, so that's almost never. And then you've got only about 12% of people who are on the right side of the scale saying that they've had someone reach out. And so I asked, how frequently are you reaching out to your coworkers to see how things are happening? And again, you see here, over 1 in 5 said never. If you combine never, you know, 1 in 2, that's half of people said they don't. So it's not just that we aren't getting that that support. It's kind of modeling for us. We don't necessarily give it. And then there's one person, one respondent on that far side who's just always on the phone and always texting people, being like, how are you? And kudos to that person. So this is a case of saying that, you know, we know incidents are going to happen. We know that there's going to be tough times, and that we start to now paint this picture of what it means to deal with incidences. This is facing the inevitable. This is not saying, well, if we just never have incidences, then we'll never have to deal with this. This is happening. It happens not just in this industry. So what are we going to do about it? So that brings me to stand-up comedians. And you might be like, that's a weird transition. Why are we going from doctors to stand-up comedians? And the reason why is that comics enter high-stress situations weekly and voluntarily. They are some of the bravest and most foolish creatures that I know. Does anyone here do stand-up comedy? 1. All right, so you will understand this. Anyone else who's presented and felt a room not give them any love will understand a bit of this. When you bomb, you feel it deep in your soul. You feel this heat coming from no one paying attention to what you do and no one responding, and you still keep going. So I talked to some of my stand-up comedian friends. I said, okay, you're clearly not well in the head, but why do you do this and how do you recover? And the thing is that they will inevitably bomb, right? This is not a case where you just go out there trying to be perfect. They understand that this is part of the process to go out there, try new material. Maybe it doesn't work. Maybe it does. And they have to get back up at the next time. So During the incident, this is what my friends who are stand-up comedians said they do. They acknowledge something is going wrong. So if you've ever been to a stand-up routine, they do that sometimes. They kind of acknowledge, they do a meta-acknowledgement that the room is not paying attention to them, that they're not interested, and it almost breaks the tension, because everyone can agree, yes, whatever's happening on stage is not working for them. And then they lean into the moment and realize it's a learning opportunity. I think that's really cool, that there can be chances or times when they go up there, the material isn't working, they don't necessarily make it personal, they go, this is a time for me to grow. This is a time for me to learn. And I think what that does is it unscrambles them from the panic of the moment. When something goes wrong, we often panic and we often worry. But if we can transform that into a learning opportunity, that's a pretty interesting insight to get from them. And then afterwards, they contextualize it at a higher level. So my friend Joel says that if he can basically only bomb 1 to 2 times out of 10, he's doing well. That's pretty big. He has been now on The Tonight Show. He has a Comedy Central special. He's a professional in what he does. And yet even he'll acknowledge there's going to be an inevitability to me bombing on stage. That's what happens when you try new things, when you try different things. And I'm just going to accept that on a higher level, that's okay. They figure out how things went wrong and what they'd fix. So obviously with the RCA questions, some of this stuff is coming back to all of you because you've all done them. And they understand how to mentally get back to a better place. I think that's really important, that we don't just think of this as something that just happens, that they actually sit down, they go over the failure, and they go, now how do I recover and get back to where I need to go so they can get back on that horse? Because they inevitably know they need to be doing stand-up again just to keep being good at what they do. So, I want to take a minute to actually underline this idea of understanding how to mentally get back to a better place. How are people coping with what's happening to them? So, we return to the straw poll. And this time, it's a percentage. So, on the left, you see it goes up to 45, but it's not the number of participants. This is now the percentage. The one on the far left says, I spend time on a hobby or something that I find fun. And almost half of people say that that's what they do, which makes sense. I go to a movie, I go out to a nice restaurant, I do things that are enjoyable to try to break out of a bad spell. About a third of people say I spend time with people I care about, which is often important. I talked about the benefits of being social. We get now to about 1 in 4 saying I talk with someone about how I'm feeling. So we're seeing that there's a drop now, that there's a lot of things that people do on their own, and then as they're looking for help, that continues to go down. Similarly, I get a good night's sleep, so people are trying to sleep it off. And then about 1 in 5, so about 20%, say I exercise. What was really neat was even here in this straw poll, about 7% of people said they do mindfulness. How many people here have tried mindfulness before? Can you raise your hand? Oh, that's amazing. I love seeing that. Well, guess what? I'm going to try doing something different. We're going to try a mindfulness break right now. Now, if this panics you, don't worry. I'm going to go through the rules. You don't have to participate in it. But I feel that sometimes actually trying something versus just hearing about it is so powerful. So, here are some pointers before we start. You can choose not to participate. You don't have to do this. You can just take the next 3 minutes and do whatever you like. I will say, though, that you know, if you choose to like quickly check your email during these 3 minutes, or you go and check Twitter, I literally saw someone, I don't know if this is TMI, they were in the washroom and checking their phone at the same time. And I feel like at that point, we need to start thinking about how we use our phones. Maybe don't do that. You can still, again, no judgment, but maybe consider not taking this time to quickly run onto Twitter or check your email. There's no right or wrong way to do this, okay? This is a problem I had when I first started doing mindfulness. I said, ugh, crap, I'm doing this wrong. I'm thinking about something else. I can't seem to focus. I'm not getting any benefits. That's not the point of mindfulness, okay? So no matter how you do it, it's fine. What we're going to do is we're going to close our eyes and we're going to breathe in for 4 beats, and I'll count you through them, and then we'll breathe out for 4 beats for about 2 minutes. Now, as a reminder, 2 minutes is not a lot of time. 2 minutes is 120 seconds. It is, let's see, it's about 1/11th of an American sitcom running time. So very, very short amount of time. But I'm curious to see what happens if we take those 2 minutes. And I want you to feel how long those 2 minutes can actually feel when we're doing this exercise. During it, some guidance is to focus on how the breath feels. Okay, as you take the breath in, feel how it expands your lungs, how your body feels, and as we breathe out, I want you to feel how your body feels during that exhalation. And lastly, thoughts are gonna happen, okay? You don't have to fight them. I used to do that with mindfulness. I used to think that I was failing because I was trying to fight the thoughts as they came along, but you also don't need to follow them anywhere. All right, so I'm gonna look at the clock so I can get a sense of how long we're gonna have, and I invite you to close your eyes. Did not time that. Whoever that is, just feel free to answer your phone or turn it off. It's kind of perfect though. All right, so we're gonna have, so just close your eyes now. And we're gonna breathe in for 4 beats, okay? Breathe in, 1, 2, 3, 4, and we're going to exhale now 4 beats. 1, 2, 3, 4. Breathe in. 1, 2, 3, 4. And out. 1, 2, 3, 4. All right, I'm going to let you just keep breathing on your own. And while you're doing that, think about all the air filling your lungs and how that feels to have that air inside of you. And as you exhale, feel that release. Feel it exiting and how your muscles are feeling during that. And go in and out. And it's okay if you're having thoughts. It's okay if you're thinking about stuff, but you just don't need to follow it anywhere. And however you're doing this is just fine. It's perfect. All right, we're actually coming to the end of our 2 minutes, so just start thinking about how you're feeling. Just make a note of it. We took 2 minutes to just breathe in and out. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes. All right, how are you all doing? That was 2 minutes, that was 120 seconds. And it can be really easy for us to think that we don't have time for 2 minutes, we don't have time for a break, but we do. And hopefully it's 4 o'clock, it's late in the day, hopefully you feel a little bit refreshed from that. All right, so we're gonna move into my next example now, Olympians. So why did I choose to look at what Olympians do? Well, it's because they face incredibly high-stress situations. I can't imagine what it's like to train for many, many years and then have that all on the line for often an activity that only takes a couple of minutes to complete. And oftentimes, you know, because you devote so much time, a lot of your self-worth gets wrapped into that activity. And if you fail, you often are doing it on a global stage. I think that it can be helpful to sometimes think about how the things that we face, you know, it can feel to us like the whole world's watching, but they're not. But in this case, sometimes they are actually for Olympians. And what Olympians are starting to do is there's research in something called self-compassion. So I'm just going to read this first quote, which is from a paper done by Masowicz et al. From 2013. Effective stress and emotion regulation requires that athletes possess personal and social resources and effectively employ an array of cognitive and behavioral skills. And basically all that means is that to hit the level of performance at the time that they need, you have to be very good at handling your emotions and your stress. And so they worked with athletes to perform self-compassion. And athletes were asked to journal expressing understanding, kindness, and concern as they would talk to a friend in the same situation. And that's, I think, pointing to the fact that we often are our worst critics. That when we talk to a friend, we're able to be much more understanding to them, but we often don't turn that understanding around for ourselves. And we should. We should treat ourselves in the same way that we treat our friends, with the same kindness. And so I'm going to walk through some of the qualities that they discussed during this exercise and see if you can relate to some of them, especially after a particularly stressful or embarrassing moment. So on the negative side, we can have self-judgment, a sense of isolation, and over-identification. And what that means is just that we look at things and we end up projecting them on ourselves too much. On the positive side is self-kindness, common humanity, that's an understanding that we are all in this together, and mindfulness, which you just did an example of a couple of minutes ago. What does self-compassion mean? Well, it's self-kindness involves being understanding and accepting towards oneself in times of adversity, opposed to being overly self-critical or highly judgmental. Right? How many times in movies have we seen that when someone fails, what they do is they automatically start judging themselves. They start critiquing themselves. They start tearing themselves apart. And we think that that's the way to do it, that that somehow makes us better because we're going to damage ourselves into a better state. But the research doesn't back that. Instead, self-kindness is the way that we get better and we get back on that horse. Common humanity is the acknowledgement that one's experiences are not isolating, that others have similar experiences. So I hope you're seeing this tie back now to the doctors and their feeling of isolation, that many of them felt like they couldn't talk to someone else because they were worried about how others might perceive them. Instead of saying, we all go through this, we can all deal with this together. And mindfulness involves a balance among thoughts and feelings, opposed to suppressing or denying them. That's why during the exercise, I didn't say, if you have thoughts, immediately stop them, try to control them. Instead, it's acknowledging them and trying to find a balance. Being mindful is the opposite of engaging in over-identification, where one is overly reactive and excessively involved with cognition and emotion. And I think we can all recognize this, where we go into overdrive and we start letting our emotions and our thinking take over. And instead, that's what drives us, instead of being able to see things clearly. Now, what happened? I mean, I just gave you a bunch of jargon. It's probably stuff that you may have heard before and maybe thought, I don't know if this can work. What were the results that they saw? So they looked at four measures: state rumination, state self-criticism, concern over mistakes, and self-compassion. And what does state rumination mean? These are the questions that people tend to ask themselves during state rumination. Did you find it hard to stop thinking about the problem afterwards? How many times have we dealt with an issue and then just dwelled on it over and over again, thinking about how we could have done things differently, or what could we do next time, or how could we have reacted this way? When thinking about the problem afterwards, did your thoughts tend to dwell on negative aspects of it, or how badly you felt about it? Right? I've felt that before. When you make a mistake, you go, I shouldn't have done that. I don't get why I did that. I could have been better about this. I should have reacted better. I'm going to be smarter next time. I'm going to be stronger. And lastly, did thinking about the problem tend to make the problem seem worse or make you feel worse about it? And that can be a big thing. So I am I learned this word, ambivert. So I'm usually pretty introverted. My ideal night is just like reading a book and having a glass of wine. But I can be extroverted when I need to be. But if I make a social faux pas, I tend to dwell on it. I go, oh my God, this thing I said to someone 3 years ago, they must remember, and I'm sure they hate me for it. I can never talk to them ever again. I'm just going to have to shut them out of my life because obviously I'm embarrassed. And I'm sure the person often doesn't even remember. That's something I had to learn to kind of just openly ask, like, hey, this embarrassing thing I did. And they'll be like, no, I don't know what you're talking about, but I'm glad to see you. And that was me overthinking a problem, making it worse than it actually was. What happened with self-compassion? Well, over 3 weeks' time, just 3 weeks, and these are for Olympians, these are people who are working at a really high level, you can see a statistical significant drop in state rumination. In state self-criticism, so I forgot to give the context for this. They compared this to a control group who was just taught to just write about their feelings. So one group wrote about their feelings, the other group actively worked on self-compassion and writing to themselves like they would with a friend. And the results are drastic. For self-criticism, a huge drop compared to the control group. For concern over mistakes, again, a huge drop versus the control group. The control group started to worry even more about their mistakes, and you can see that the group that did self-compassion decreased in their concern. And in self-compassion, a huge climb again. So the control group that just wrote about their feelings, they were less compassionate about themselves over time, and the group that did perform self-compassion saw it increase. And what this tells me is you don't have to do all this. You know, if this stuff you're listening to be like, cool, 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 but this is not something that you think, you know, will fit in what you do. All I want you to take from this then is that this is intentional, not innate. If we think that we just naturally heal and we naturally recover from things, that's not actually a great assumption. This is us being intentional about this and trying to find ways to recover so we can accomplish the things that we want to accomplish. So let's continue asking the question of what incident response looks like for humans. How do we support ourselves? How do we support others? How can we support others supporting us? And here's what you can do today. I don't want to leave you with just a bunch of stuff about how, you know, tough it is to do this without leaving you anything. You can do your own survey. You know, do an anonymous survey at your company. Make sure that it is truly anonymous because you're asking people to be quite vulnerable here and see if your results match up. And again, it's not to say, well, then you did something bad. You're unearthing a problem, and now when you've unearthed it, you can start solving it. And look at the responses and see if they work individually, how they work as teams. Try to really understand what the process is that's happening there. What are some of the sticking points that are creating problems? And then audit how you support people and see what opportunities exist. Maybe just asking, saying, hey, after an incident, why don't we go up to the person and just say, hey, how are you doing? Is everything okay? Maybe that person says, I don't actually need that type of support, but at least you're being open and intentional about it. Let's disassemble hero culture. What does it mean to be human, not superhuman? For example, during your next RCA, think about some things that are based on just our natural biology. So understand that timing matters. I was reading this great book by Daniel Pink called When, The Science of Timing. And basically, we should never or very rarely be making big decisions in the afternoon. We have a trough, and there's a lot of research around judges and students and other people who have to perform, and they perform much better in the morning than they do in the afternoon. Maybe we should consider this and say, let's make sure that our RCAs happen in the morning when everyone can be in the right mindset for it. Introduce meaningful breaks, even if they're a minute or two long. You don't have to do a mindfulness exercise with everyone for 2 minutes, but maybe you could as well. Encourage a break and make sure that break is a real break, not a break where there are still ties involved or there's not an ability to disconnect, because we're human beings. We need that time to recover. An interesting thing from the book that I liked was this idea of vigilance breaks. So in hospitals, before a surgery, some hospitals will actually create a card where everyone has a checklist of their role and what their responsibilities and what they're going to do in that role. And they say it not because they're new to this. They're not saying it because they don't know what they're doing. But it's a chance for them that even if they're tired, they can go through the different things and remind each other. So maybe during an RCA, you've got different roles for different people doing things. Print out some cards, have everyone go through them. That way you have an idea of what everyone's expected to do. and it's a fresh reminder. And this allows us to kind of counteract some of that natural unwinding that we have as humans. And lastly, one really neat thing, there's a nonprofit that I work with, and before every meeting, we discuss access needs. I've never heard of this before, and the first time I did it, it was a bit weird. But what they do is they will say if there's something that might hinder or distract them during the meeting. So someone might say, I have ADHD, I appear not to be listening, but I am, or you just need to repeat it twice for me. Or someone said, I have worse hearing in my left ear, so if you're going to talk to me, please try to talk to me in the right. And it feels almost weird to be so intentional about this, but we often make assumptions about how people are interacting with us, and we never ask them. And I found that in those meetings, it was really neat, because then when people looked like they were drifting off, I could actually go, oh no, actually, this thing happened, and this is why they're acting this way, and it created better communication. I actually believe that we can make everything better. Like I said, I think this room is full of very, very smart people, and if we put some attention to the right problems, we can make the lives of really our coworkers and ourselves better. We can help us have better concentration, better mood, sleep better, want to be social with one another, but we have to ask these questions first and honestly look at them, not with any fault, but just say this is something that maybe we haven't taken a look at. How can we improve it? Thank you.